Good morning, everybody. Welcome. My name is Max Wardman, and welcome to a program that we have scheduled for deciding how to make tough medical choices. I'd like to discuss this in general, the idea we have here. This is a series that's been going on for a number of years that we've been organizing to deal with the issues of how medical health issues and halakha intersect wherever we need to get into these issues. Risk is all around us. We need to make decisions with uncertainty about the completeness and the reliability of information. Desired outcomes are not guaranteed. It becomes clearer when we are facing illness and must decide what course of action to take. Uncertainty abounds regarding the illness, how and whether to treat it, or even in procedures that are not life-threatening, but still involve risk. How do we get medical information, and what bearing does Jewish law have in our decisions? As observant Jews, what insight does halacha provide for discharging our desire to make decisions that are consistent with the letter and the spirit of the law? A word about our sponsors now. As I said, this is a series that's been going on for a number of years. We have the support of Bikur Cholim, which is a very worthwhile organization that some of you have had a chance to use, to benefit from, and it's allowed us to continue to have these programs for over a decade now. And a number of community synagogues have been supportive. I think all the synagogues in this area, all of the observant Orthodox synagogues have supported this program. The planning has been undertaken by Rabbi Rosenbaum. We've been very supportive of this program, this series of programs, and Dr. Sierra Hella. Before I introduce our speakers, I want to give a caveat. It's important to know that we're providing general concepts to improve understanding. It cannot take into account all the issues specific to individual situations. Discussions with your doctors and your rabbis are essential to provide you further guidance information. Here's the format. We're going to have three or four different types of situations that we want to look into. Each of the speakers will address the situation back and forth, and there will be some sort of culminating remarks. We hope to have about 15 to 20 minutes for questions. If we run a few minutes over, those of you who cannot stay can leave. But what we appreciate the opportunity to have the remarks so that you get a sense of some of the concepts, the different kind of concepts. So, the speakers. It's really a pleasure to introduce our speakers. They are, like many of other speakers, members of our community who teach and engage members of our community and are helpful and highly respected. They are available for conversations, for guidance, and I know a number of you have gone up to each of the speakers in different ways to get guidance, support, very detailed support. So we're very, very pleased that we can continue this conversation in this format. A word about our speakers. I'll start with Rabbi Grossman, Yitzchak Grossman. It's important to note that in addition to being a rabbi and a Jewish legal scholar, that he comes also from, he's been trained by people who are the highest caliber. Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who is the son-in-law of Rabbi Auerbach, is the one who gave him smicha. He has served as a dayan, was a Beis Din of Meir Sharim, Beis Din of Kollel, Beis Din of Havad, also the local Vad. Numerous articles, numerous presentations. Some of you have been to a number of them, including those in the synagogue. He's a Rosh Chabura, senior lecturer. So his specialties are Choshen Mishpat, civil and family law. We could go on for a while, but I think it's important to note that he not only gives presentations in a synagogue setting, but also engages people in a work setting. So he's very much involved in community and talks on a... People have heard him before. I'm impressed by the range of both Jewish and secular knowledge that he includes in his presentation. Dr. Theo Heller is a gastroenterologist who specializes in liver disease, and he has been trained in many places. He received his medical degree from University of the Witwatersrand. It's in South Africa. I'm sorry about the pronunciation. He's been a doctor for over 2.5 decades. In addition to being a senior investigator and researcher in a national institution, which we cannot name, We also know that he has extensive experience in emergency medicine in suburban. So I just want you to know that we have somebody who has a lot of experience. He brings the research in his labs to the clinical medicine that he conducts. So this is a very rich background for both speakers. And so I will start with Rabbi Grossman, and he and Dr. Heller will continue by changing their presentation.
Thank you very much, Max, for that very generous, gracious introduction and for putting this whole program together. Thank you all for coming. So I'm going to speak first a few minutes just about introduction to Jewish attitudes, hashkafic and halachic, Jewish thought, as well as Jewish technical law attitude toward risk. Then we're going to proceed to discussing a number of categories of scenarios, actual scenarios, and Dr. Heller will provide the medical understanding of them, the background, the details, and I'll discuss some of the halachic reaction, the Jewish law reaction in general to these scenarios. So a little bit about risk, about medical decisions and risk. So in the course of preparing for this event, I read an article by Rabbi Dr. Avraham Steinberg. Many of you probably have heard of him, one of the leading medical halachic experts in the field today, tremendously erudite and thoughtful individual. He was actually involved in crafting of legislation in Israel, discussing these types of issues. But he makes the point, one very important way in which Jewish law differs from the reigning paradigms of modern Western society is that in modern Western society, personal autonomy is pretty much virtually the only value, that everything else yields to that. Jewish law certainly doesn't disregard personal autonomy. Certainly patients, they do have some say about their care, but it's very much not the only value. We have, in this week's parasha actually coming up, the Torah says, v'chai bahem, that the mitzvahs are given that a person should live, as understood in the Talmud. That means that the Torah places a premium on life, that even though mitzvahs are important, Shabbos is important, other mitzvahs are important, they almost always yield to the categorical imperative, the prime directive of preserving life. Almost anything we do to preserve life, and again, Judaism also is not about absolutes. Very often when you read a discussion of one of these contentious issues, which gets a little polemical, you'll find people speaking in absolutes. This is absolutely prohibited. This is absolutely required. Very few things in Judaism are absolute, are really absolutes. There are almost always nuances and details. That's why, as Max mentioned earlier, as we're going to reiterate today, what we say today is mostly going to be about understanding the issues, understanding the interplay, understanding the themes, and what kind of questions you need to ask and what you need to understand. But there are no simple absolutes. Everything is pretty much, as in any sophisticated system of thought, everything is about weighing competing values. But it is fair to say that Judaism has a very, very high regard for life, and personal autonomy plays a relatively lower role on the scale of values than it does in Western thought, and this is what Rabbi Steinberg addresses, that had to craft laws that on the one hand respect, especially the modern notion of personal autonomy, while on the other hand, being true to the Torah does not always, is not absolutist about personal autonomy. The Torah does sometimes say that, and this is something we know in the rest of Torah too, the Torah has a lot of halacha which is not limited. The modern Western society is typically about absolute autonomy. The laws following John Locke are only legitimate when they regulate harming somebody else. The law should never tell you what you can personally do in your own life. The Torah, of course, is not like that. The Torah has lots of things to tell us about how we should conduct our personal life. With regard to questions of risk and medical decisions, the point is really twofold. First of all, there are mitzvahs here, like Shabbos and Kashrus. The Torah has mitzvahs about preserving life and other commandments and directives about how to deal with situations involving danger to life. Moreover, on an even deeper level, we often have the idea expressed by a variety of thinkers in Jewish thought that a person's body is not his. We have a slogan, it's my body. The Torah doesn't really recognize it is yours to some extent. You're its caretaker, and you do have some authority over it. But at the end of the day, you know, we're gods. We recognize that everything we have is from him. Everything we have is he's in charge. And we recognize that he has to be the one we consult. The Torah is what we consult to decide how to resolve questions, thorny questions about what to do. And, which doesn't mean that the conclusions we reach are going to be always diametrically opposed and completely different from those we would reach by any other system of values. But it is an important point to understand that we are approaching this often from a somewhat different perspective than a modern secular system of values might. Now, with that being said, the ultimate values, the core fundamental values that we're going to consider that are going to be sometimes in conflict with each other are going to be, of course, A, we have preservation of life, which is generally of paramount importance. B, but there are other things too. Halakha does recognize other considerations beyond the preservation of life as the only value. Again, we're not absolutist about it. Rabbi Rosenbaum once said that the idea of quality of life is something that's really foreign to the halakhic discourse. Halakha doesn't have the notion of quality of life. And this is, of course, certainly true. However, the halakha does sometimes recognize that severe pain, for example, might be something you take into account when deciding to preserve life. Halakha is not going to allow murder, not going to allow active euthanasia generally, but the question is withholding treatment or not doing extraordinary measures, that's something we have to consider. Again, you read some of the polemics and you see these absolutist statements about nothing ever can be weighed against life, which is not true because some things do sometimes weigh against life. I saw a fascinating and startling thing again, preparing for this talk. I saw Rabbi Yaakov Emden writing in the 18th century. He's talking about things like kidney stones. I remember once reading a biography, I think of Cromwell maybe, where he may have suffered from this stuff, and they were talking about, like, you see how excruciating these things must have been, that people underwent surgery without anesthesia and without modern surgical technique, because the pain was just so unthinkable. Rabbi Yaakov Emden says that can a Jew undergo something like surgery in the 18th century, using the methods they had, and the lack of any kind of analgesic techniques and so on, that any effective ones, can you do that? He says, like, not really. I mean, halacha doesn't really allow risking life just for pain. On the other hand, we don't judge, he says. If someone does it, we don't protest, he says. We understand that the overwhelming pain, the sheer excruciating pain, is something that halacha recognizes too. And if a patient wants to undergo surgery for it, despite the Russian roulette quality of surgery like that in the 18th century, we understand it. We don't necessarily accept it, he says, but we understand it. So halacha does recognize that there are other factors in the human condition aside from life. There's pain, human dignity. There's the question of, the Talmud says, that better that someone should allow himself to be thrown into a flaming furnace than to humiliate somebody else, despite v'chai b'hem. The Talmud seems to say, like Tamar and the story of Tamar and Yehuda, he would have let herself be killed rather than force humiliation upon Yehuda unless he chose to confess himself. Now, there's a lot of discussion about whether that's normative or not, whether it's just a kind of agadic point about the importance of human feelings and so on. But at the end of the day, we do have a lot of values that we have to consider aside from the preservation of life. And as we discuss the specific scenarios, we're going to see more about the interplay of these values. On the one hand, if you really took the absolutist position that life is the most important thing, the only thing, and everything else is set aside for life, You wouldn't do things, we'll discuss later, questions like cosmetic surgery, for example. You can't do anything because there's some risk and nothing can be put on the same scale as risk to life, and that's it, end of the story. But it's not like that, as we'll see. So that's what we have to discuss. We have to discuss the Jewish attitude toward making complex medical decisions. They're tough. And halacha doesn't make them easy. You know, sometimes people will turn to religion because they think it simplifies things. It doesn't necessarily simplify anything. It gives you a frame in which to approach them, and hopefully it makes us feel that we're doing the right thing, and hopefully it will understand that we have it. We're not unmoored. We have a way of finding the right thing, what the Torah says, what Hashem says. But they're going to be tough. And then moreover, again, as Max said, and we have to reiterate, we're going to discuss the underlying rules. In this particular area, situations are always different, the details are always different. The halacha is going to give us some general rules, general guidelines, A, in terms of values, B, in terms of how these values are weighed against one another. But at the end of the day, it's difficult to paskin, to rule on one of these questions on one's own. The situations are always different. Certainly, a competent authority should be consulted, but at least the goal of our program is to lead you to understand what the issues are, what information you need. The halacha is only going to be as good as the information that you get. Halacha has to deal with actual facts. Hopefully we'll understand what questions have to be asked, what information is needed, and then what the language is, what the vocabulary is. And therefore, it'll lead, hopefully, to a more constructive, more productive dialogue between a person who, again, we hope we don't have a lot of tough medical choices, but unfortunately we often do. Hopefully that will lead us to a better understanding and an ability to have a more productive, more effective conversation with those who we discuss it with.
So I too want to start by thanking Rosh Hashanah, and I want to thank Max very much for being the driving force behind this, and Bikur Cholim for being as wonderful as they are and doing as much chesed as they do. I think they've really changed the tenor of the community, and for people who come in with illness, make a huge difference. I want to thank Rabbi Grossman for putting up with me and for dealing with my sloppiness. And I agree with everything he said. I'm not going to repeat. I'm going to give a different perspective. I learned one or two useful things in medical school. Not many. One of them was in a class talking about risk. And I don't know if the story is true or not, but this is the story the lecturer told us. He said that this was during the height of the Cold War. And he said that a new American ambassador who was fluent in Russian was being shown around some military facility, very different to medical facility. Military facility, and there was a poster saying, in the event of a nuclear war, this is what you're meant to do. And the ambassador laughed, and he said, what are you talking about? A nuclear explosion, there are no survivors. And the Russian, showing him around, said, for the one in a million who survives, this is true. So when we're talking about risk, we have to understand that even one in a million matters, right? If you're Joan Rivers, going in for a minor routine outpatient procedure, and you die from it, then you're that one person. So this is not just a theoretical discussion. This is not a discussion in the abstract. This is a very real discussion where there is real risk and real things do happen. So I want to start by framing it like that. Not to be too somber, but I want to make sure that we're all clear that this is not just a tangential abstract conversation. And as a physician, we take these risks very seriously. They're frightening. And we're going to talk about some of them as we go through. In medicine, risk assessment is very simple. The first is the patient has the right to choose. First is the burden is the patient's. My job is to tell you the numbers. My job is to explain to you what you're dealing with. But then you make the decision. The problem with that approach, and the problem with saying, here's some resources, look it up, is that it takes away the experience. It takes away the understanding and the nuances and the subtlety, which is very important in practice. I recently did a webinar for the American Association for the Study of Liver Disease, and one of the participants brought up a model that the Mayo Clinic developed. It's how to assess surgical risk in a patient with liver disease. And the model has four decimal places. So it's a percentage. So let's say your risk is 11.2345%. What does that matter? As an individual patient, how do you make sense of that, right? So there's an inappropriate exactitude in some of our models. And when the doctors give you these numbers, they don't always give you a real sense. So I'm going to try and give you a different framework. So we think about it in two ways. First, what is the procedure? And second, who is the patient? And then, in terms of who is the patient, there's one more risk stratification. Do they have any significant organ damage? And most importantly, cardiac. So let me put that into context. If you're talking about a hernia repair, it's not the same as having half your liver removed. Right? So procedurally, there's a big difference. If you're a 35-year-old with no medical problems, it's very different to an 80-year-old with hypertension, diabetes, history of cancer, had chemotherapy, multiple other things. So when we talk about risk and doctors give numbers, it has to be in the context of that patient and for that procedure. If you're a 35-year-old and you're completely healthy except for significant heart disease, I'd rather be the 80-year-old. Right? Heart disease is a big one. There are classification systems and there are scoring systems just based on heart disease. So let's summarize. You've got to think about the procedure and the patient. The burden is generally on the patient. There are some specific examples, liver disease, kidney disease, heart disease, especially heart disease. And based on those, we come up with a number, and we come up with an approach. Okay. Any questions about any of that? No. Okay. So now I'm going to give two scenarios to start. The first is a little bit exotic, and the other is less exotic, and it's something we confront every day, literally. And then I'll hand over again to Rabbi Grossman. The first is, you all know that there were three patients with Ebola who came to the NIH. So what right does a physician have to take care of a patient with Ebola? Think about the physician's family. Think about the physician's community. Think about the other people shopping in Shalom's. Right. What right does that physician have to take on that risk? Is that fair? Is that correct? That sounds pretty dramatic. Let's put it into context. When you take care of an Ebola patient, there are three levels of getting dressed. At each level, you're being watched by someone. When you go into the room, there are two people in the room at all times. One person just watching the person who's doing things. You're not allowed to be in the room for more than 2 hours in case of fatigue. Coming out, you go back through the three levels. So the real risk of infection in that context is probably really extremely low, close to zero as you can get. The bathrooms are specially designed. If you think about flushing a toilet, but if you think about flushing a toilet, the spray actually spreads for about 6 feet. If you think about detergents, which we use in hospitals and use at home, it decreases the surface tension of the water. In other words, it makes it even easier for the droplets to spread. So they spread even more than 6 feet. And detergents don't kill 100%, they kill 99.99%, the best. So what they did here in the Ebola unit is their toilets don't flush. Everything just drops straight down. The sinks don't have a bottom. There is no spray. The air is handled in a different way. So the whole area is engineered in a way to minimize risk. So when you say Ebola to someone, I know one of the nurses taking care of that patient had problems with her daycare. They kicked her kids out of the daycare. But actually, the risk is close to zero. Second scenario, and then I'm going to stop. Multi-drug-resistant bacteria. This is something we face every day. Every hospital in the country has it. Every single hospital. There isn't a hospital in the country that hasn't had a patient, unless they don't see patients, where there are bacteria that are resistant to multiple antibiotics. This is an increasingly important problem, and we're all exposed to it. And this is kind of a stealth thing, because if you're healthy, you're okay, and then you get sick, and the bacteria takes over, and it's very difficult to treat. That's a significant risk exposure. So what right do I, as a physician, have to expose myself to things like that, and then come back in the community? With that, I'll stop.
When we discussed a physician or any kind of healthcare provider providing care to someone with a contagious disease, there are really two issues we have to consider. The first, as Dr. Heller mentioned, is the question of risk to the provider's family, provider's community, provider's people he meets in the street. But second is the physician himself. As you mentioned earlier, halacha doesn't give you carte blanche to just expose yourself to any risk and whatsoever. There is a rule of a chai b'hem that you have to be concerned about your own safety. So both these questions we have to consider from a halachic perspective. If there's risk, can you treat the patient at all because of your own safety? And furthermore, what about exposure to, what about passing the risk on to others? So the latter question in particular is discussed in one memorable tshuva, one responsa by Rav Chaim Palagi, a leading 19th century rabbinic scholar in Turkey, in Smyrna, Izmir. He had a case, it was some kind of plague, the 19th century was full of them, we don't usually get a proper medical description of what they were, but there was some kind of heroic doctor who was treating patients, plague patients of some kind, patients with some kind of outbreak, and he tried to go to shul. Everyone in the shul said, "Whoa, wait a second, it's nice that you're doing this stuff, but you're not getting near us." And he said, "Well, I'm a member of the shul, it's my right to go to shul." And they said, "Well, we're also members of the shul, it's our right not to catch whatever you have from your patients." So they went to a din Torah. What's the halacha? Can he demand that he be allowed to attend shul? Can they demand that he be excluded from shul? His basic ruling is, again, one of the things we're going to return to over and over here is that we don't really get numbers and quantified risk, certainly not to four decimal places, but usually not any numbers at all. We get very, very general qualitative terms like high and low and much and little. But Rav Chaim Palagi basically establishes, his ruling is a fairly simple one. He goes on for a few pages, but the basic points of his ruling are quite simple. He says, A, halacha does recognize the notion of contagion. This is last week's parsha, he says. We read about the mitzora. He says that the leper, the mitzora, is expelled from the camp and is badad yeshev. This is unusual. Other types of ritual impurity can eat kudshim, can't go into the Beis HaMikdash, but there's no special quarantine rule, he says. The mitzora is quarantined, badad yeshev, by himself. Nobody can go near him. A number of the medieval commentators say that is a form of quarantine. We're afraid that his leprosy or whatever tzaras is contagious. His breath, his vapors, and he's contagious. We want to keep him isolated so that he doesn't pass it along to anybody else. As a matter of fact, one sefer even says, it says, al safam yata, he should wrap his face in a garment. Someone says that was a form of breath mask. The goal was to keep his breath from infecting anybody else. So Rabbi Palagi says, halacha recognizes the notion of contagion. He brings some earlier sources who seem uncertain about it, but the normative view is, he says, in light of the medieval sources, halacha recognizes contagion. Second, halacha recognizes that I have a duty, it's my responsibility, not to act in such a way that can bring harm to somebody else. I can't even allow my property to be unsecured in such a way that it can conceivably bring harm to somebody else. I have to lock things down. Even things that can just be dragged around by dogs or winds, I have to keep them all secured so they don't cause problems. Certainly, I have no right to go into a shul if there's a realistic chance that I'm contagious. The people in the shul are perfectly within their rights, he says, of denying him entry. Again, we don't know how contagious it was or how lethal it was or much of the details here, but the basic principle, he says, in the example of the daycare, again, we take good care of our healthcare providers. We know what we're doing, hopefully, if you're in a good institution, and if the risk is really close to zero, this logic wouldn't apply. But insofar as there would be a legitimate, significant risk to anyone that the provider comes in contact with, society certainly would have the right to say, if you want to do that, fine, but don't. It's not on us. We don't want to have to put up with this. In terms of the right of the doctor, the nurse, the provider, him or herself, to provide the care in the first place, Rabbi Palagi doesn't even acknowledge that's a question. He seems to take for granted this is what the doctor was doing. Good for him, noble soul. But in terms of the direct question, should a doctor, may a doctor, must a doctor provide, or a nurse or anybody else, provide such treatment to a contagious patient, this is discussed by a number of contemporary authorities. And the general consensus is that the healthcare provider may, and probably even should, or even must, provide care, assuming, again, the risk is not that high. So I saw, for example, Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, a leading authority today in Israel, he talks about a case of a pediatrician, a woman pediatrician, who was pregnant, and she was called upon to treat a child, I think, with rubella, adamant. So a pregnant woman who catches rubella is at serious danger for birth defects, of the worst things for the pregnancy. The question was, again, why she had to be the one to do it, why they couldn't find another doctor to do it, a male doctor, a doctor who wasn't pregnant, I don't know. But assume this is the fact, assume she was for some reason the only one who could do it. Should she, may she, must she treat the patient? Rav Zilberstein goes back and forth, but his basic rule is, if there is significant risk, certainly if for some reason she cannot take proper precautions, if she's unable to mitigate the risk, and the risk is high of her catching it, and the risk is high, significant to birth defects, then certainly she should not treat it, shouldn't risk the child's life, shouldn't risk her own life, and so on, and that would be the wrong thing to do. However, the mere fact that there is some risk is always, you know, one in a million. If it's you, that's not much of a comfort, as Dr. Heller said. The fact that there is some risk, he says, is not a reason to avoid providing treatment. And the standard he uses is one that we find in other areas of halakha too. The standard he uses is risk that is considered normal, that people do in the course of earning a living, in the course of their daily life. You can't suddenly say, when it's your job and patient care is the issue, no, I don't want to do it anymore. For example, we know that in the Talmud says someone takes a sea voyage, he brings a carbon toda. Today he says the Gomel blessing. Today we don't necessarily believe that these voyages are very dangerous. Airline travel is fairly safe, certainly on a per mile basis. We do it anyway, according to most poskim, for various reasons. But in Talmudic times, it was actually considered to be significantly dangerous to take a sea voyage. The ship sank and they were sacked by pirates and so on, and it was really dangerous. Yet people did it. The Talmud never says that it's prohibited to take sea voyages. So the many authorities, using different formulations, establish a general rule, again, without numbers, without quantifying it, but a general qualitative standard they give, that risks which society considers normal, which this individual considers normal, which he would do in his daily life for earning a living and for other parts of functioning in modern society, whatever society he finds himself, those risks are considered allowable and are not considered reckless, unacceptable self-endangerment. And Rav Zilberstein uses a similar standard with regard to patient care, a risk that you would normally do in the course of your life, and you wouldn't say, I can't do this, this is unacceptable. You can't suddenly invoke when you're dealing with a patient, but if the risk is much higher, if the risk is unusually high, a risk that someone would not take in his personal life, then he would not be expected to and should not take such a risk in the course of patient care either. Rav Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, another leading, relatively modern authority, has an extensive discussion about the provision of medical care. The way he conceptualizes it is, or Zilberstein too, on the one hand, the rule is Judaism does have a mitzvah, a binding mitzvah, a binding obligation to save somebody's life, to be a good Samaritan. Sorry, that's another religion, but to save somebody's life is generally a requirement, an obligation, but not at the cost of your own. Not even, Norman of Halacha says, at the cost of significant risk to your own. Someone's drowning. If you don't intervene, he's definitely going to die. If you jump in, he may pull you under or you may both live. There is a lot of debate about this, but the more or less consensus view is that you do not risk your own life to save somebody else from certain death. Not even clear that you're allowed to do it. Some say that if you do that, you're a chassid shota. But in general, not recommended, certainly not required. Sort of, that's Rav Waldenberg's starting point, that if a doctor is really going to take significant risk and accept upon himself significant risk to provide care, even if by not doing so the patient will die, he shouldn't do it. However, in the case of the medical setting, he comes up with a number of reasons for why he should. He says things like, there's a mitzvah of Arapa Yerape, that since that special mitzvah will provide him divine protection. He says that's his job. We find a doctrine in many halakhic authorities that things you do for a living, the Torah acknowledges that employees, they didn't have OSHA back then, employees climb scaffolds and climb trees. That's why it was so important, the Talmud says, to pay workers on time, because he literally risks his life to earn his livelihood. And apparently many poskim establish that it's permitted to accept some level of risk, not, you know, Russian roulette level risk, but some level of risk to earn a living, so the doctor's earning a living. Society needs it, he says. Society considers the provision of medical care, again, like Rav Zilberstein, normal and standard. Society needs it. If nobody provided care to people, like an epidemic, certainly society would break down. It wouldn't function properly. Because of all these reasons, you can debate the cogency of individual reasons. Because of all these reasons, Rav Waldenberg feels that, again, he doesn't define how much risk is acceptable, but certainly says you should do whatever medical science, medical care, whatever standards say are the most effective way of avoiding it. But if you do whatever you can, certainly if you can get the risk down to zero, or near zero, that's great. But even if you can't, if there's some level of, like with Zilberstein, society, normal, tolerable risk, you need to do it insofar as you're a doctor. You can and even should do it. Rav, another leading medical ethicist of our time, Rabbi Avram. So for Abraham, he brings a similar position from his Rebbe, Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth. He says that who asked you to be a doctor? You don't want to treat contagious patients? Don't be a doctor, he says. You sign up to provide medical care. You sign up to provide care according to the standards of that profession. I don't fully understand the logic here. If the Torah says you shouldn't do it, then signing up doesn't allow you to do things that would be usher. But they take for granted also, that's your job. That's what society requires of you. You knew that going in. You should have known that going in. And the consensus, therefore, is Rav Vosner, Shevna Levi, same thing. So the general consensus is that a doctor, medical professional, should accept at least some level of risk. Again, not more than necessary, obviously. You certainly should take whatever precautions are possible and practical in the situation. But if you do so and there's still some level of unavoidable risk, fairly low levels of risk are considered acceptable. High levels of risk, like the rubella case, are not. The question is where to draw the line. Again, that's back to, as we said before, individual cases will have to be discussed with someone knowledgeable in this area.
So now we'll switch gears and we'll look at risk from a different perspective, from the patient's perspective, and I'll give two scenarios. The first scenario is something that we do relatively frequently, cardiac bypass surgery. So there are lots of reasons to do bypass surgery, and the numbers I'm giving are global. There's some indications for bypass surgery where if you don't do it, death is almost certain. But let's not talk about that. Let's talk about a case where the benefit from the surgery is about 70 to 80% of the patients will have improved quality of life or length of life. So not 100%. Right? So 70 to 80% of people who undergo this procedure will have some benefit. The risk of death from bypass surgery in excellent hands is about 1%, 1.5%. And if you're over 75, the risk of death is about 3.5%. So if you're one of those patients who die, and were also not one of those who would have benefited, then that was terrible. Right. You see the conundrum. So for the patient, it's a conundrum, and for the physician, it's a conundrum. You're recommending it on a population basis. But for the individual, it may not be applicable at all. Let's go to a second scenario. Second scenario, liver transplant. 15% risk of death up front, 100% of risk of death without transplant. That's very different. But there is a twist. That risk of death up front is immediate within the first few weeks or months. Maybe that person would have lived for 9 months or a year. Right. So you may shorten someone's life, although they definitely benefit in the long term. So two different risk assessments, both in terms of death. One in terms of possibly paying a price in terms of time, but certain death, the second case. And the first case, paying a price in terms of death or injury without absolute guarantee of benefit.
Anyone who has any significant involvement with halacha arrives at the conclusion, sometimes frustrating, sometimes exciting, that halacha is complicated and there's almost always a disagreement about everything. This question is one particular area in which halacha actually speaks with a pretty unified voice. It actually has details can always be complicated, but the textbook halacha actually has a pretty straightforward and pretty simple attitude toward this type of question. To introduce a little bit of the halachic terminology, as we've mentioned over and over, halacha considers preserving life paramount importance. Halacha distinguishes between what we call chayei olam and chayei sha. Chayei olam means normal, a person can live a normal lifespan, years, decades, whatever it is. Chayei sha means that a person, we're talking about short-term life, a few days, maybe a couple of weeks, exactly where you draw the line. Again, quantitatively is not so clear, but the halacha has a distinction between chayei olam, meaning saving somebody's life for indefinitely, use a rough, imprecise term, and chayei sha, limited short-term life. The general rule is that accepted by many, many achronim is that we are willing to potentially sacrifice chayei sha, sacrifice limited life that a person have to save him, for even the possibility of saving chayei olam. The Talmud specifically talks about a case of seeking treatment for a serious condition from a practitioner who is untrustworthy, who is some kind of barbarian, who's as likely as not going to kill you, but he may save you. And according to some authorities, even if there's only a relatively minor chance he'll save you, he may save you. But more likely than not, he'll actually kill you. Some would say that until the era of modern medicine throughout the 19th century, that was true for all doctors, possibly, but you read about the methods they were using in the 19th century. But certainly, modern medicine is very different, but you just read Victorian literature, you'll see how barbaric and misguided so much of the medical profession was, even though bees were killing people until relatively recently because they didn't realize you had to wash your hands between performing autopsies and delivering women. So the Gemara talks about this case of getting treatment from some kind of barbaric practitioner who's more likely to kill you than save you, or equally likely, and the Talmud says, we do it anyway. Because, a case where the patient is terminal, at do nothing, and he may live chayei sha, may live a couple of weeks, but that's it. So we're sacrificing his potential chayei sha for a chance, at least some chance, at chayei olam, and that is recommended, and that is pretty much accepted by pretty much all the later authorities. Going down the last 300 years, we have numerous poskim, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Eliyahu Henkin, Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, earlier authorities, later authorities, have all pretty much accepted the same basic rule that we are willing to give up a chance for Chayei Sha, even a certainty of Chayei Sha, if the operation fails, he won't even have that, for the chance, at least some chance, that he will have Chayei Olam. How much chance he has to have, how much chance we require is less clear. Rav Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva actually rules that even if the chance, as I've alluded to before, is less than certain, even it's less than 50-50, it's not shakul, it's not even if the chance is a relatively small chance, it's still, that chance is so valuable to us that we weigh it above the value of chayei sha. Again, in practical, real-world scenarios, how long is the chayei sha, how little is the chance in general? So these questions, again, are details that will have to be analyzed, but the basic rule is that the value of chayei olam is so much more than the value of chayei sha. Now again, as Dr. Heller mentioned, we can distinguish between cases where if you don't die right away, you'll definitely live. Cases where, even if you don't die, the operation may not benefit you at all. Or cases where, conversely, you might have lived anyway without the operation. We don't really know. All these cases may make a difference in individual judgments, but in terms of the general rules laid down by halakhic authorities, they don't normally distinguish between most of these things. They generally assume that for a significant, however you define significant, for a significant chance at chayei olam, we would generally be willing to sacrifice chayei isha. The way some of the writers conceptualize this, they say that there is a pasuk in Parashas Mishpatim, the Torah says, v'rapo yirape. The context is someone who injures somebody else, he has a duty to heal him, to pay for his healing. And the Talmud says, mikan shenitein reshus l'rofe l'rapos. From here, we see that the physician has license from the Torah to practice his craft. And all the scholars, medieval, later authorities, all wonder, permission? I mean, it's a no-brainer. Why do you need permission? Saving lives is a great thing. Helping people is a great thing. Why does the physician need any permission? So there is a school of thought, going back to the Ramban, other authorities, that we're talking about a dangerous treatment. We're talking about something which has significant risk. You may actually kill the patient, and the doctor might say, first, do no harm. That's my first duty. The Torah says, no, rapa yirape. Yes, of course, you should first do no harm, but at the end of the day, everything is weighing, you know, everything is making choices and weighing, making the tough choices. If the choice is between possibility, significant possibility of saving chayei olam, the doctor should not say, I don't want to do any harm, reflexively just back away. He should say, no, I have to look at what's going on, and if my treatment has a chance of saving the life of a patient, even if it's going to sacrifice, there's a significant chance it'll sacrifice chayei olam, sacrifice chayei isha, then the rule is, it is the right thing to do, and it should be done, and of course you should worry and do his best not to cause the adverse outcome, but if he's doing the best he can, and this is recommended, then that is what he should do.
So for the third scenario, we're going to talk about risk without clear medical benefit. And we talk about medical, we're talking about physical medical benefit. But before going into it, I just wanted to say that we've been talking about procedural risk because procedural risk is easy to quantify. But think about prescribing a medicine. There's risk in prescribing a medicine. Someone can have an adverse reaction. And for sure, over your career as a physician, you will prescribe medicines which people will have allergic reaction to and even die. So there's risk even in prescribing medicines. That's much harder to quantitate, so we're not going there. It's much easier to talk about percentages. So what about cosmetic surgery? Think about cosmetic surgery. So I'm not talking about someone with a nose like mine, right? I'm talking about someone with a regular nose who woke up in the morning, decided they didn't like it. I'm not minimizing cosmetic surgery. I'm not judging cosmetic surgery. Don't misunderstand. This is for the context of the discussion. So someone who's not going to derive any immediate or long-term medical benefit, but wants to have a procedure that will change their appearance because they think that will make them look better. So the risk of anesthesia is death is about 1 in 10,000. The risk for a medium, let's talk on the scale of cosmetic procedures, medium risk cosmetic procedure, probably 1 in 3,000, 1 in 5,000 risk of death. So we're talking about 2 or 3 in 10,000 risk of death, not talking about infection or injury or other things like that. For a procedure that has no health, physical health benefit, mental health is a different category, right? I'm not saying that doesn't count and doesn't have value. It does. But in terms of physical health, when we're talking about healing, physical healing. So as a plastic surgeon, which I'm not, that's your job. That's what you do. You take that risk every day. You don't think about it. But for the patient coming in, are there things to consider?
This may sound a little bizarre, and it may just reflect a quirk in my reading rather than the objective state of the halakhic literature, but there was actually a lot of discussion in the 20th century on this question about the legitimacy of cosmetic procedures, maybe even more than in the formal halakhic literature than on the previous question of things like bypass surgery and liver transplants. Well, transplants have seen a lot of discussion in recent years, but there actually is a tremendous amount of literature over the 20th century, mostly on the subject of cosmetic procedures, plastic surgery. I may sometimes be using the terms imprecisely and interchangeably, cosmetic and plastic. Cosmetic generally means to make you look nicer. Plastic, I guess, is a more medical term, refers to the reconstruction of tissue that doesn't involve the function and the underlying organ systems as much. But there actually are a dozen, more than that, two dozen tshuvas on this over the 20th century. It's actually an interesting case study as to how halacha reacts to changing technology, because you see very different perspectives taken in some of the earlier tshuvas, 50 years ago, 75 years ago, and the attitudes, you can actually kind of watch them move as doctors have gotten better at it, technology has gotten better, and they've developed better understandings of how they can do it safely and effectively without subjecting the patient to too much risk. Before I start that, though, I just want a brief comment on, Dr. Heller was very careful to mention that we're dealing with cases where there is no medical benefit, not to speak of mental health. It's become increasingly the trend today, of course, to insist that mental health be treated as a branch of health. It's the same. It should no longer be considered an inferior, kind of less significant sibling to physical health. It's a complicated issue, but I'm not going to go too deeply into that. Probably a subject worthy of its own talk a different time. But I'm just going to mention briefly a couple of things I saw while doing some of the preparation for this event, is that there is actually some very interesting discussion, again, mostly over the last century or so, over whether how high a premium halacha places on medical health per se is, in the most stark, kind of most raw form, is the risk of someone having a nervous breakdown, some kind of mental collapse. Is that considered pikuach nefesh? Could you be mechal Shabbos? Can you feed somebody pig's flesh, something completely non-kosher, to prevent or to cure mental illness? And there actually are poskim who have taken the position that mental health is considered pikuach nefesh, either on a very simple level, cause suicide risk, or the risk of actually causing harm to oneself or society. Obviously, today we have entire DSM manuals full of all different kinds of mental health. You can certainly distinguish and discuss what kind of mental health, how severe, what condition, and so on. They're not all the same, obviously. But there are poskim who have at least taken steps in this direction of classifying mental health as the equivalent or almost the equivalent of a risk to life. Others have been more reluctant. This comes up a lot in halachic discussions of things like abortion, where the general halachic attitude is that we don't allow abortion on demand, and we certainly allow it for danger to life. And the question, one of the common questions was mental health of the mother, if there's a chance of pregnancy will lead to some significant mental condition. And poskim actually debate as to what halachic valence to assign something like mental health. Again, the terms are often basic and not well-defined in terms of modern criteria, but that's just something worth noting, that mental health at least has begun to be recognized by poskim as possibly a very serious issue, possibly approaching pikuach nefesh. But returning to classic cosmetic surgery, as Dr. Heller said, we're not usually dealing with cases, most of the tshuvas are not discussing people who were at risk of an actual mental collapse if their nose continued to be the way it was. We're dealing with cases of people who wanted to look better. But the truth is, even within that, we find, if you read the tshuvas carefully, we find a fairly wide variety of cases of what they were dealing with. Most of it is body image, obviously, but body image means different things. Some people it just means wanting to look really, really good. Some people it means they think they can't get married. Looking the way they do, they think that they're unattractive and are doomed to romantic failure. To some extent, sometimes they're talking about improving their marriage as it is. And also, there are some cases we just want to look a little better, want to have a straighter nose or whatever it is, or some cases where you have an actual condition, too much sweating or too much something disfiguring, either congenital or scarring or just some kind of... So the poskim, they use different terms like plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery, nituach plasti, and so on, liofi, but they don't use the terms precisely and rigorously, and it is very important when comparing different rulings that were issued on this topic to compare them across the whole spectrum of what exactly are we talking about. So when we discuss the literature here, there are several different issues. The first issue is the one Dr. Heller mentioned, that is the issue of risk. The poskim clearly distinguish, also clearly articulate both the risk of the anesthesia as well as the risk of the procedure itself, whether infection or any other type of risks attendant on cutting into the body. The second thing they discuss, though, is completely independent of risk. The second issue they discuss, and this is really relevant for all surgeries, although it's usually going to be moot for a serious surgery, and that is the issue of self-harm. In addition to the Torah having a mandate to preserve life, your own life, anyone else's life, There was also generally a prohibition against self-harm, cutting yourself, even simply depriving yourself. The Talmud actually says that unnecessary fasting or even simply abstaining from wine, the Nazir is called the Chote, the Talmud says, according to some opinions at least, because he's deprived himself of a harmless pleasure. Alcohol obviously is not a harmless pleasure. The Talmud itself recognizes that in other contexts, and we certainly know that today. But the idea is that certainly actively inflicting harm, cutting into the body, and even lesser forms of harm are actually prohibited. In general, the prohibition is called chovel ba'atzmo, self-mutilation or self-harm is generally prohibited. Now, when we're dealing with serious surgeries for serious conditions, everything we've discussed earlier, the bypasses and the transplants and so on, the issue is moot. Everyone agrees that to provide medical treatment for a serious condition, there's no question the fact that you're cutting into the body is fine. It's for refuah, it's for medical purposes, it's to achieve something significant, saving a life, or even just significantly improving health. So the issue is generally moot. When you're dealing with a medically recommended procedure, there's no issue of self-harm. But once we deal with cosmetic procedures, which by definition are less essential and less obligatory, then in addition to the question of unnecessary risk of the anesthesia and the surgery, we also deal with the questions of self-harm. So as I said, these questions have been debated for about 3/4 of a century. They wouldn't have come up much earlier because they simply didn't have the technology to do surgery successfully without unbearable pain for relatively non-essential reasons, for elective reasons. I mentioned earlier, Yaakov Emden says that people underwent surgery for kidney stones because the pain was excruciating, but you know, that's kind of an exceptional case. That it wasn't life, but the pain was so great, so that might also be a reason. That would also be much more probably because the goal of alleviating unspeakably severe pain, cutting yourself a little bit now, would also probably be much more just weigh the pain against itself, short-term pain against the long-term pain. That's probably also not much of a question. The question is, again, when it comes to cosmetic surgeries, where there is no real physical pain you're alleviating, again, it might be mental pain. Once again, we have to get back into that question of how does halacha view mental pain? But the poskim don't usually conceptualize in that modern way of mental pain being the equivalent to physical pain. Usually, the way they phrase the question is accomplishing something that's meaningful to you, feeling better about yourself, better body image, better success in finding a life partner, and so on. Are those good enough reasons to engage in surgery? Now, the general consensus here is yes. The general consensus, again, you read the earlier tshuvos, they're a little more equivocal. They're more worried about the danger. They're more worried about risk for an unnecessary reason. But in general, as time goes on, as you read the tshuvos down the decades, 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and so on, the later tshuvos tend to be more consistent, they've reached a consensus that these types of procedures are permitted. When you deal with chovel ba'atzmo, self-harm, as Rav Avadya Yosef puts it, he says, we pierce ears, he says, you just punched a hole in your ear, we do it, because you know it's not so bad, and it looks good, and women like it, or men like it today, whatever it is, and men liked it in biblical times too, and it's fine, he's talking about women, not men, but he says, again, you see that we're not worried about chovel ba'atzmo when it's something relatively minor that's being done for a legitimate purpose. And that's pretty much the consensus of most poskim. Most poskim have accepted that chovel ba'atmo, Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about it, where he also argues that Rambam's language is that the prohibition of harm, harm of another, harm against yourself. The Rambam has some vivid language. He says the prohibition is to injure somebody, derech nitzayon or derech bizayon, in a combative manner or in a degrading manner. That's the prohibition. Anything done for constructive purposes, Rav Feinstein concludes, is fine. And that is generally the consensus there with regard to the self-harm. It's not so simple. Rabbi Feinstein himself has other tshuvas which are difficult to reconcile. Rabbi Feinstein actually prohibits or is reluctant to permit dieting if it isn't being done for health. If you're simply depriving yourself of food so you can look a little better, Rabbi Moshe is actually not sure that's mutter. He says that you're hurting yourself and harming yourself for no good medical reason. Again, if it is a medical reason, that's certainly okay, he says. If your doctor tells you you'll be healthier if you lose 10 pounds, that's certainly mutter. But you're not going to be better, you won't be worse, but you won't be better. You'll just look a little better and you'll feel cravings and feel hungry all the time. Rabbi Feinstein is actually not sure that's mutter, and there are other tshuvas he has where he seems less reluctant to just take for granted that any goal you want to accomplish is a sufficient justification for self-harm. But in general, the trend among halakhic authorities is if you have some kind of constructive, meaningful reason for doing it, we don't worry about the self-harm. Similarly, when it comes to the danger, again, the frustrating thing, once again, is that the poskim rarely give you numbers and quantify danger. As Dr. Heller says, you know, certainly if you're the one person, it's not much comfort. And even if you're not, 3 in 10,000 are, you know, way too high. I've dealt with doctors myself, and I've asked them about risks of something. Says, oh, it's very low. How low? 1 in 10,000. That's not low. 1 in 10,000, that's a real... if I don't wear a seatbelt, the odds are still probably not that high that I'm going to die in a car crash, but I would be crazy not to wear a seatbelt. Again, there the cost is relatively low, and here the benefit maybe is higher, but at the end of the day, the doctors are pretty cavalier about telling you the risk is low. Like Dr. Heller said, that's what they do for a living, so as far as they're not the one that's taking the risk, and for them it's low. But in general, some postcom have been nervous about this, but the trend of halakhic authorities over the years is to say that, again, referring back to that general doctrine of risk society considers normal, since these procedures are quite common and they're done all the time, even pulling out wisdom teeth carries some risk and people do it, anything which is society has decided is commonly done, many posts can use that as a kind of standard, that is something which is halakhically permissible, and that is probably the consensus. Posts can try to distinguish, the procedures are shorter, risks of anesthesia they suggest might be lower for shallower anesthesia, shorter anesthesia, depends obviously, once again, back to the details, what kind of anesthesia are they doing, for how long, and how, and so on. That's right, beyond my knowledge, certainly, but in general, the trend has been to allow these things. There is one outlier here, and that is the position of Blaise Yehuda Waldenberg again. He was, he's a very interesting thinker in general. He was one of the leading experts, one of the greatest halachists of the generation, as well as being a particular specialist in medical halacha. And sometimes the positions he takes are kind of very progressive and very modern, like he's one of the more lenient authorities on things like abortion. On the other hand, in some issues, he takes a very reactionary, kind of very hardline approach. This is one of them. He says, who are you, he says, to think you know better how to design your body than God? God gave you this body. It's the way he wants you to look. And to say it's self-harm, to cure, to adjust it, he says, is arrogant and presumptuous. And the Torah gives you permission to heal illness. If you have a legitimate, real illness, the doctor is allowed to heal it, he says, but just for cosmetic reasons, he says, there's no heter, both because of the risk and because of chovel batzmo. He actually is reluctant to permit cosmetic procedures, but again, he is very much the exception that proves the rule. There is a pretty strong trend line, again, certainly as the medical technology, medical techniques have improved, there is a fairly strong consensus that has developed that these types of procedures are mutter. Again, many of the postmen who allow it, we're talking about scenarios, they weren't just for frivolous reasons, like they want to look better at parties. They were because they actually felt that they really had serious body image issues. They felt, I don't know if it was clinical depression, but they were really frustrated with themselves. They really felt, rightly or wrongly, they were having trouble getting married and so on. So it is important, again, even in this area, to consider case by case, both in terms of the medical side of the question, the risks, as well as the personal human side of the question, what are you actually trying to accomplish by this procedure? But once again, broadly speaking, the general trend here is to be more lenient and to allow most procedures of this sort.
Last set of scenarios. The first one I'm going to give you we didn't really discuss. I've been thinking about it as we've been sitting. What about someone who wants to donate a kidney to transplant? The risks are very low. Kidney donation, people live normal lives afterwards and they do well. What about donating half your liver? The risks are a little bit different. There's a 2.5% risk of death, and there's about a 16 to 20% risk of serious injury. Serious injury meaning permanent disability or being in the hospital for more than a month. But you're going to save someone else's life, except for the 15% who might die up front. This is not experimental, this is standard. This is pretty standard, but brings me into the last set of scenarios, which is experimental work. Two possibilities to think about. The first is something from my practice, hepatitis C. There's a drug that's FDA approved that will cure 99% of people. But we ask people to come in, and we'll do a liver biopsy before treatment and after treatment. The liver biopsy has a 1 in 1,000 risk of death, 1 in 300 risk of serious bleeding, requiring transfusion. So we're asking you, who've got a curable disease, who don't need the liver biopsy, to come in and have not just one, but two. and there are people lining up at the door to do this. And the reason we're asking you to do this is not because you'll benefit, you won't. There's only increased risk for you. But because of what we'll learn from you, maybe we'll do much better with others. And secular society recognizes this as a valid reason to put individuals at risk. The last experimental scenario would be someone who has a terminal disease, someone who has a terrible condition, and the experimental therapy itself is of potential benefit. But the side effects aren't known, the risks aren't fully described, and the benefit isn't for sure. So the last case, so we said volunteering for donation for half your liver with a risk to you, no benefit to you except for the altruistic benefit, potential benefit to the recipient. Second, you have something that's very curable, but you put yourself at risk so that science, future patients benefit. And the last, there is potential benefit for you, but that's completely undefined both in terms of risk and benefit.
It's good that this event is going for another 2 hours because now that Theo threw in the organ donation. Organ donation is something which is probably the subject of an entire lecture on its own. Just very briefly, again, halacha has evolved over the last few decades as the technology has improved. The general consensus on organ donation is that it is permitted. And again, we say organ, we mean things like kidneys and livers, where you'll generally survive by giving it, most likely. Not hearts, or brains, they don't do brains yet, but soon. Which is a whole different question, but things like kidneys and livers, the general consensus has developed over the last few decades that it is permitted, not required. It's too much to ask of someone to give up tissue, an entire organ, to undergo the risk of the procedure. So generally, the rule would be it is not required, but if someone would like to do it, it's considered a great mitzvah. Again, every case is different. How much risk, other factors, and so on. As Dr. Heller mentioned, the risks are, kidney, for example, are quite low to the donor. I read, when I was looking into this once, that one of the greatest risks is if you only have one now, so if anything happens to the second one, you're in trouble. So one of the few lifestyle recommendations they make is take care of your last one. You know, wear protective gear if you play contact sports and make sure that you take very good care of your one remaining one. But aside from that, you pretty much aren't any real expected downside, aside, of course, from the non-zero numbers of the surgery itself, like any other major surgery. So that halacha generally considers the benefit of saving the life versus the relatively minor cost to you, minor risk and minor cost to you. Halacha generally considers it a great mitzvah, but not required. It's too much to ask. Liver is more complicated, given that there is, let's say, much higher danger. But still, the consensus, I think, would generally be that it's probably a mitzvah, although certainly not required. Just a couple of words on the questions of experimental procedures. Here, I think it would be fair to say we're actually on the experimental edge of halacha too on this. There is much less literature, much less major precedent on the general question of experimental therapies. It's been discussed in the halachic medical journals by people who deal with this thing, like Steinberg and others, over the last few decades. But there's much less in terms of solid precedent by major poskim here. Just a couple of brief points on the topic. Rabbi Abraham asked Rabbi Waldenberg again, assuming we're dealing with an experimental procedure which is of limited or no risk to the donor, but he can possibly contribute something and help science advance, is Rabbi Abraham actually suggested you're mechuyev to do it? There's a mitzvah upon you to advance medical science and do it. And Waldenberg said that's a bridge too far to actually let yourself be experimented on and give up tissue and get cut and so on. He thinks it might be a mitzvah, but it wouldn't be something that halacha would actually require. In terms of procedures like the biopsies, Dr. Heller mentioned, where there is real risk, it's very far from zero, it's low, but it's obviously the medical ethics guidelines wouldn't allow you to do it if it was really high, but if it's, you know, it's significant, albeit low. So the medical profession, the research guidelines have one set of rules for weighing benefit against risk, and halacha does too. Although, again, it's much less defined. There's been much less discussion about how you would make that trade-off. One contemporary article I read, deals, in addition to the question of risk, even if there's no risk, he deals with the question of chovel batno. We discussed earlier the prohibition on self-harm. even if the biopsy would have literally zero risk of mortality, but the mere fact that you're getting yourself cut, is this considered the possibility of tenuous benefit in the future? It's kind of a paradox. On the one hand, we know that medical science advances by research, and there is no real way to advance medical science without research. On the other hand, most research fails. Most things don't succeed in most individual experiments. Individual things aren't going to do anything. So the question again becomes, do you look at the aggregate? Do you look at the individual? Do you say, I'm cutting myself, and it's very unlikely that this particular procedure is going to save the world? On the other hand, the system has to be designed in such a way, because that's how science works. There was actually some similar discussion several hundred years ago in the context of autopsies. Back in the 18th century, Poskim debated whether halacha generally frowns on the performance of an autopsy. Halacha allows it in specific cases. Certainly, to save a life, the consensus would be if two people are dying of the same fever or something, and by one dies, and by taking him apart, you can figure out what's going on and have a real chance of saving the other one. The consensus, not everyone agrees. Some say that the preservation of human dignity is paramount. It doesn't allow you to do that, but most Poskim say you would do that. But, however, when the question then becomes, I have no other immediate hope of a cure, it's just basic research, it's going to teach me more about the disease and more about the anatomy of the body and the progression of the disease, and the hope is that the more science learns about the body and the disease and the organisms that carry it, that'll lead us to a cure in the future, but it's all, you know, long-term and tenuous rather than anything direct. So the Noda Behuda, Michezkel Landau, and the Chasam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, both ruled that we cannot allow autopsies to be done in the hope of some general, even though that's how science works. Again, science back then, you know, may have been more primitive, they may have been less, they may have been more pessimistic about science really working well. I don't know if they would have changed today, but they actually ruled, and this is the normative view, that we don't simply allow prohibitions to be done today, Shabbos or Kashrus or Nivul HaMeis. We don't typically allow averus to be done today on the hope that in the long run they'll yield some benefit to science. On the other hand, when you're dealing with something like Chovel Batzmo, we've already seen that many authorities say that the prohibition of self-harm is permitted when there's some constructive benefit. You can't violate Shabbos for some constructive benefit. You can't eat pig's flesh for some constructive benefit, but specifically the prohibition of harm is more lenient in this sense in that it is allowed when you're not doing it for nihilistic reasons, worthless reasons. When you're doing it for a constructive purpose, that's not the prohibition of self-harm. That's constructive. That's not harm. That's constructive cutting into the body. So therefore, you certainly could make the case that even a more nebulous, tenuous benefit to humanity would be allowed to override the prohibitions of Chovel Batzmo. Not everyone would agree, but that's at least an argument that you can make. Regarding the more serious question, the question of actually doing procedures that have serious risks of harm, that becomes a much more problematic issue, and that definitely will fall back on the consult a competent authority before contemplating that.
We've heard now in law presentations. It's a chance for you to reflect with some questions, and we'll try to get some answers. Nancy.
Thank you.
First of all, I thank Max, but I also want to thank the presenters. I think this is very valuable and very important, and many of us have to deal with many questions. I do very much appreciate that Dr. Heller mentioned medications, because medications are a very big part of decision-making as our lives go on. But I also want to say, and it's beyond the scope of this presentation, that all the complications and depths and layers of decision making are exponentially made more complicated when the person cannot make the decision themselves, and perhaps you or I are the person who have to make decisions for that other person, who either because of their condition, such as they become very sick and are not conscious, or they're too young, they're children, they are too old and they cannot think clearly, or you have need very often trying to explicate or interpret from what you know, many years of knowing them, or whatever, you know, it could be six, your mom did, that you have to make decisions about operations, about care, about medication. And I will child has a kidney that could be given to another child. And I've even heard cases of parents trying to get pregnant, and this can be debated on its own program, of trying to have a baby who might be compatible with the child who is dying. Thank you for opening this conversation, but it is a very complex and important conversation.
You got several questions in there. I'm not sure how many we can make an
answer.
I don't
know if it was a question. It was sort of more of a monologue. But sorry.
Do you have any reflections on any of this?
Yeah. So I certainly agree that this is a critical question, and this is really a whole other dimension that I haven't really touched on. So part of this goes back to what I began with, that on the one hand, halacha has a lesser role for personal autonomy than modern systems do. On the other hand, the role is not zero. Personal autonomy does play some role. I mentioned earlier the story of Tamar that says she was going to, the Talmud literally taken seems to indicate that she was going to throw herself into the furnace, which allow herself to be thrown into the furnace rather than humiliate Yehuda. People ask. I saw Rav Asher Weiss, a temporary rabbi, asked. Very nice. She was willing to do that, but she's carrying children in there. He said, no one asked them if they wanted to go into a fiery furnace rather than humiliate Yehuda. So this comes up in the laws of Mila, circumcision. So we know the usual rule is that when there is significant risk to the Mila, we don't do it, no matter what. And when there is no risk beyond ordinary Mila, then we do it. There actually is a middle ground that potentially some posts can actually deal with an intermediate ground, that there would be a certain intermediate level of risk which a person would have the right as an adult to decide he's willing to do Mila in these circumstances, but he would not have the right to impose it upon his child. There actually is such a level where posts can take such a position. There are other areas in halacha where we do say that parents do have the posts can do explicitly say parents do have the right to impose the level of risk they feel comfortable with on their kids. There's a tshuva I like to quote often from the Milta Docker, Biana Leinsofer, about a group of families who wanted to make Aliyah. That time, there again, travel was a non-trivial thing to do. And people actually objected. They said, you want to go to Israel, if you're on a listed decision, fine, but you're taking children with you, you're taking a family. We have to step in and stop you from doing that because you have no right to make the decision for them. In this case, Rabbi Landsofer actually rejected that argument. He said, and he establishes a general rule, any risk that halacha would allow a person to take for himself, he has the right to impose upon his family. But as you said, it is a complicated question. Certainly the more exotic forms of that question where you're doing something that's going to primarily benefit one kid at the expense of another, you're actually going to have a kid for that purpose, those certainly are more complex questions, and I'm certainly not going to go there right now. Sorry.
Dr. Hill, you want to add anything? Next question, if any. Audrey. Come on front if you want.
To echo before anything. Thank you very much. My question was, before Rabbi Grossman, I think you mentioned something about one way that Poskim will look at whether or not certain elective procedures, but maybe even non-elective procedures, can be done is whether or not there's a general consensus that this is something we do, like making pierced ears, for example, or more things than that. I'm wondering how much the Poskim today are balancing that, or have you seen any evidence, that's the word I'm actually coming to, of the post-game balancing what we generally do with whether or not there's evidence to support what's generally done. In other words, those two things don't always match up. People may take lots of antibiotics, for example, or things that can't be cured with antibiotic, but how much are they starting to look at evidence-based treatments, and sometimes that may conflict with what's usually done, and does that inform their decisions at all?
Can you restate the question?
Yes. So the question is, I mentioned in several different contexts, I mentioned a doctrine espoused in one form or another by a variety of authorities that instead of giving quantifiable to four decimal places levels of amounts of risk, Poskim have often said that we look at things that people, individuals, society consider normal and acceptable risk versus things that not. Now, on one level, we hope that people are rational, and the risk they take somehow line up pretty closely
somehow track pretty nicely the levels of risk involved objectively. We know that people are not, you know, the great revolution of behavioral economics in recent years, people are not, you know, homo rationalis. People do not always make their decisions exclusively, entirely based on rational considerations. So the question is, what do you do when we find some cleavage between, what a strictly rational society would do and between what society has found or individuals has found actually do? It's a good question. I don't have a really good answer. One interesting case to consider, and again, in a slightly different context, might be smoking. So for centuries, people smoked and they thought it was good. They thought it was good for the digestion and so on. And in the mid-20th century, you know, science began to realize that smoking was really bad, and people stopped smoking. The rates of smoking, the level of penetration in society have obviously gone down quite a lot. You know, maybe more in the U.S., less in France, and so on in Israel, but, you know, but in general, there's been a trend. Now, obviously, the trend is not always going to dovetail exactly. There are going to be cases where science has already begun to recognize sometimes that something is not acceptable and is, you know, reckless, and society hasn't quite followed. So the question is, what do you do in those cases? So there is a halakhic principle that we find in many contexts called Shomer Psarim Hashem, literally God watches the fools, which means the halakha allows the assumption of some risk, which objectively we wouldn't really stomach, but if society has decided that it's acceptable, that halakha does allow it. So there is room for such a doctrine. I just have to say, this is just because it's funny, but it doesn't really shed light on the matter. My Rav, Jeroen Talmud Chacham, back where I grew up, when he was a yeshiva student, he used to say that his rabbi, a great Rosh Yeshiva, used to still smoke. So once the student wanted to, you know, make him feel better, comfort him, he knew there was an expression, Shomer Psarim Hashem, which he thought meant Hashem takes care of tzaddikim or something. He said, no, you know, Shomer Psarim Hashem, he told his rabbi. And when he later learned what the phrase actually meant, he was quite chagrined about it. But there is this idea that halacha sometimes recognizes. But even when it comes to smoking, for example, smoking, there did reach a point in the late 20th century when many poskim have said, no more Shomer Psarim Hashem. Well, A, because society has accepted that it's dangerous, but B, poskim have said, we know it's dangerous. Since objectively the information we have has, Shomer Psarim Hashem doesn't allow Russian roulette. It allows, again, it's not defined well, but it allows certain relatively low grade types of risk assumptions, but not when it crosses third line. So I think, I don't have exact sources for you, but I think on the whole that's what it would depend on. That in certain cases with a slight difference where the risk is not that high, the halacha might still say we defer to societal norms once the risk exceeds a certain point. But there are posts who have said that things like dangerous leisure activities are also, parnassa maybe you can, sea voyages, but just taking dangerous voyages, I don't know what the examples would be, I'm afraid, to give an actual example of pitchforks, whether it's bungee jumping, skiing, climbing Mount Everest, but there are people who say that that's not acceptable. Some people do it, some people don't do it. But yeah, so it's a good question. I don't have a better answer.
Okay, go ahead, please.
What about a clinical trial? Where you're taking a risk.
Can you repeat that?
Repeat the question, please.
The question is, what about clinical trials? So not all clinical trials are created equal, somewhat like people. And clinical trials are divided into essentially three phases. First phase, four, really. First phase is where you assess safety of the medicine, often in normal volunteers. Second phase, you're trying to assess whether there's any possible benefit. Third phase, usually that's where you see there's a reasonable benefit and you want to explore that and understand the correct way to treat patients. Fourth phase is after the FDA approves to follow to make sure that that's correct. What you saw in the smaller numbers earlier is borne out in the larger numbers in practice. Because real world conditions are often very different to clinical trials. I'm not going to speak about the halakhic aspects, but clinically speaking, by the time it's in phase 3, there's a reasonable chance of benefit. By the time you're in a phase 3 study, the phase 3 studies cost millions of dollars. No one's going to do that unless there's reasonable benefit. The exception is a rare disease. When you're talking about rare diseases, often the phase 2 is likely to have significant benefit for the patient. Because there you know you're never going to go to a phase 3. The FDA knows you're not going to get to a phase 3. And so they give it orphan designation. And you design the phase 2 to kind of answer the phase 3 questions as well. You kind of bring them together. So you wouldn't go to a phase two in a rare disease unless there's a reasonable chance of benefit. Not to say that it works 100% of the time. You know, we treat people with pneumonia and some people don't get better. So in the clinic, you know, carbapenem in a clinical trial, of course that happens too. But I think phase three or in a rare disease, and perhaps phase two, there's a really good chance, a reasonable chance of some benefit already. Doesn't mean guaranteed.
So from a logic perspective, it kind of breaks down to variations of the same points we've been discussing. In a case like the last case, phase two, with his benefit of even saving a life of someone, but also the risk of killing him, that becomes analogous to some of the bypass questions about if you're actually going to save a life. Just a question of quality of life, or improving the function, or the general happiness measured some way, but not necessarily saving lives. That's a more complicated question we haven't really gotten into today, about exactly how to weigh quality of life issues against life itself. That's something that can be a little bit out of scope. The earlier trials, the normal ones, are just testing something. We don't have any reason to believe that it's going to kill somebody, just making sure it's safe. That's like other questions about Hovel, Bathmo, about self-harm, or about testing something with this limited chance of danger. There's some benefit, so that again, if there was no really significant chance of harm, more likely to be okay. If it was a real safety concern and you're really risking lives, I don't think ethically you'd be doing trials like that on healthy people for something where there wasn't a clear benefit. But basically, you have to consider all these different variations and try to figure out which of these categories they would be closest to.
Okay.
I apologize, I came in late, so maybe you the beginning. Personal autonomy and using smoking as an example. So for Moshe, allowed smoking, even at a time where he knew about the dangers, because Dr. Rosner was the one who was asking those questions, and I'm sure that Dr. Frederick Rosner explained to him what the dangers were, and that Sicily Ezer would prohibit it. So in your opinion, do I have the right to decide if I want to go with the Sicily Ezer or to go with Moshe if I wanted to go with the smoking?
So the question was that there are going to be cases in this area where I've kind of focused largely on cases where there is halachic agreement, but there's certainly going to be cases in the details where there are differences. We mentioned some of the differences. So what do you do in a case where posts can have different opinions, where one posting says osur, one posting says not only is it mutter, you have to do it, or anything in between. So what does one do if there are different halachic opinions? This is really a question that cuts to the core of halachic philosophy and of living your life as an observant Jew in general. You can have the question, anything to do with muktzah, to saying brachas, to life and death situations. There's always a question about what do you do when posts can have conflicting opinions. There are a wide variety of different rules that we use to decide. Sometimes we follow simple rules like Rove, what do most poskim say? Sometimes we look for a kind of supermajority consensus of poskim. Sometimes we apply rules like Shei Bal Tase, that if there's not agreement, then don't actively do things. Safek L'chumra, Safek L'kula. So there are a wide variety of kind of meta-halachic rules that you use to resolve halachic conflicts. To a large extent, I think whatever rules you use to resolve these questions in general would probably apply similar way here. If a person has a specific rebbe or comes from a specific tradition, in the old days they used to have actual communities where they would tend to follow one posek or one halachic tradition. Talmid Chasam Sofer would follow Chasam Sofer. In Eretz Yisrael, they would follow first the Rambam, then the Shulchan Aruch, later the Gaon, or the other things, and so on. But to a large extent, I think you would apply similar rules. Obviously, if the question of harming society, like for Moshe himself as a tshuva, where he deals with secondhand smoke, then it becomes even thornier to decide, if I have a certain shita and I follow my Rebbe, does that give me the right to impose it on the public? Or like in the contagious disease cases, that becomes a question too. If you have a specific tradition you follow or a specific rabbi that you're following, would that let you impose it on the public? So those are good questions, certainly. I don't recall in the preparation I did seeing any specific discussion of how we apply these rules in the context of risk of life and medical choices, but to a large extent, I think you just apply the same rules we apply in other areas of halacha.
Rabbi Brandes?
Can you comment on, or does anybody speak about LASIK surgery?
I didn't see anything. The LASIK surgery for, I guess, vision correction, for correction of vision problems via laser technology. I'm not that familiar with it, and I didn't see any discussion on it directly, so I apologize. I'm just going to avoid it, because I just don't have that much to say about it, so I'm sorry.
Okay.
questions.
You want to comment on that?
I think that the risks are pretty clear, and the risks are relatively low. And if Gemara treats vision, I won't say this, but the Gemara treats vision in a separate category, not quite the same as other.
Cuts both ways. Danger to vision is yes. Danger to life. So yes. That makes it more mature, right. More austere.
So I think it's an even more complicated issue because of the specific nature of vision and halakhic ramifications. But I think that when you sit down with a provider, the risks are well defined, the numbers are pretty clear, and in terms of what's commonly done, it's a standard, if I can use these words, routine outpatient procedure. I don't think it would be considered exceptional risk. Halakhically, I'm not commenting, but medically.
So in a way, it might fall into the category of some of the cosmetic procedures, a procedure that provides some kind of quality of life benefit without actually improving the survivability, yes. Or function, and it might fall into that category.
To the point that you made earlier, which is that there are averages for different procedures, what about the difference among practitioners? So you can say that on average you've got this percentage, but this particular practitioner, how do you get information and whether they are average or below or higher than average?
So in general, that information is not available. In general, you don't know that. In general, you're trading on the reputation of the doctor or the institution. And you would assume that at a better institution, they track the numbers of procedures and the numbers of complications. So every procedure I do is tracked. Every complication I have is tracked. Every quarter I meet with the quality control people, they show me a graph of what I've done, what I haven't done, and where the numbers stack. And compared to national averages, compared to the average in my institution, compared to average in Maryland. So most good institutions should be doing that. There are specific things in specific states. For example, cardiac surgery in New York State is tracked very closely, and those numbers are made publicly available. Transplant outcomes are tracked very closely nationally. Every census numbers are publicly available. You can go to the UNOS database. But if you want to know the outcomes for hernia repair and recurrence rates of hernias and complications, things like that, of a physician locally, there is no way to find that. Your reliance has to be on the institution, the hospital, and the reputation.
So if you have a particular situation, you can do some research, but...
The exact numbers?
So it's available per disease, but not necessarily by individual or institution. It depends.
Well, some individuals, so in New York State, cardiac surgery, you can look up individual surgeons.
Well, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's a database called ECHO. You can go to them in New York, and they pretty much have all of the stuff downloaded.
But because in New York State, this has to be recorded and be made public.
Right.
So they just take the publicly available data and they put it together.
Right.
But you can go to there are multiple websites. But New York is pretty unique in terms of that.
So I just want to make two brief comments about that. First of all, just one medical point. Dr. Heller can, I'm sure, elaborate on this. But one potential problem with relying on raw statistics like this is you don't necessarily know how bad the cases were to begin with. If one doctor takes much harder cases and has worse results, because he's going out there on a limb and treating cases that are going to run much harder or much more other doctors wouldn't even bother with, you have to make sure that in any given type of procedure you're operating from some kind of standard baseline.
Yeah, so the famous case with that is diabetes. They pointed out there's the state and the hospitals are irrelevant, but there's a tertiary care center that the state regulatory authority went to and said, all of your diabetics have complications. What are you doing wrong? When we look at the private care people and their primary practitioners, their diabetics are so healthy. Well, that's because all the sick diabetics are going to the tertiary care institution. Right? So you have to be careful with some of this.
The other point I want to make is a halakhic point. There's a common societal thing that Jews always want the best doctors. How do you know, which doctor is good? You see how many chassidim there are in the waiting room, so to speak. So, and the truth is, this is actually a halakhically mandated, halakhically recommended idea. The Shulchan Aruch says, there's actually a siman in Shulchan Aruch in Yerdea, the laws of refuah, the laws of medical treatment. The halakha is, a doctor should not practice if there is someone else who is better than him. So the post will discuss what that means. So that Rev Wallenberg again says, it doesn't mean that if you're doing a routine procedure or earning a procedure or something, that no doctor can practice if there's someone who's better than him. If he can satisfy some some basic standard of being competent and he's good enough, that's fine. You don't need to go to the best person for every single procedure. But insofar as it's a procedure where the success is really, the outcome really is dependent on the skill of the practitioner, and you may very well get a better outcome by going to someone more skilled, it's actually a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch. The doctor should not be practicing insofar as someone else is more likely to get a better outcome. Now again, Poskim and Oldenburg again, they explained, sometimes it's not practical. That you can't travel, not everyone can travel halfway across the world from one doctor who's going to quickly run out of hours in his life to do that. So obviously it means the most practical situation, but there is actually a halacha that insofar as the quality of the practitioner can make a difference, there is a halachic obligation to that the treatment should be done by the best doctor, so to speak.
Ari, Yachin.
So what's the halachic implications of medical tourism? People that go, let's say, they want to take procedures, they want to take benefit of procedures that wouldn't be administered in this country, so they're too risky here, and maybe in some other country.
Or expensive.
Or expensive, yeah. Sometimes even they just can't get it, wouldn't be administered here.
So again, Dr. Ellerkin explained some of the background of why the procedure is not done here or there. On the one hand, halacha doesn't automatically defer to our regulatory authorities as the gold standard. Halacha doesn't have its own opinion. Halacha doesn't have an opinion on any given procedure, whether it's a good idea or not. On the other hand, we don't necessarily privilege the U.S. authorities as the bottom line. You have to get the best information you can whether the procedure is good or not good. Dr. Ellerkin can let him explain more about why these things are done, and I don't know the fact. I have no idea in general whether other countries are being reckless and whether we're being overcautious, probably sometimes one and sometimes the other. But in general, medical tourism per se is not strictly a halachic issue. The question is you have to figure out, halach often says, in this area of life and death, halach often says don't rely on one opinion, get several opinions, get a consensus opinion. If the consensus is that those countries are crazy and that they're reckless, then you shouldn't be doing it. If the consensus is unclear, then it becomes more of an issue. Talk more about this?
I just briefly say that there's a lot of medical tourism for cost reasons. Differentiate that from medical tourism for treatments that are not available. I've yet to see a treatment not available that someone could get in Mexico that worked in Mexico but didn't work. I haven't seen that. And I've seen people, I have one patient in particular I remember very sadly. He had metastatic colon cancer and he went to Mexico to some clinic. He mortgaged his house. He spent all the money, all his savings. And then he came and he still passed away. And now the wife and children who were young were left with destitute for therapy that really didn't work. And Rav Aaron addressed this. We had a session with Rav Aaron.
Aaron Lubyansky.
He spoke about this too. So things that do not have a reasonable chance of working or where there isn't reasonable evidence, he was very you can watch it, it's on the website. He was very disparaging. And he actually said it's a lack of emunah. He said if that's what you've been given and there really isn't a refuah, for you to go and look for something like that and spend your money and do it in that way could be considered a lack of, I don't want to speak for him. Watch the talk.
I would just add that one question, though, which I think is a good question, which doesn't have an easy answer, is going to be combination of all these things. What about a case where the procedure is available in both countries, it's much more expensive here, but the standards might be better here, the safety, the oversight, the regulations, so you want to save $30,000 and they might cut some corners in India or Mexico, what about that? So that is a very serious question. You have to figure out the fact, what kind of corners are being cut and how widely are they being cut, and then decide whether that's back to the previous question of the best doctor or not. That becomes a very, very tricky question. Not only are we impugn any other country for doing perfect work, but in a case where you have reason to believe that they're not as good, that becomes a question.
Hi. I was talking with a surgeon about working with a family who wanted to make sure things were done according to halakha. And she said, I am very happy to work with the family's rabbi, follow the poskim, whatever, but there are three things that could influence the decision making, and you have to work with me on this. And she said they were the police, if there was an accident or a crime situation, the law, in terms of insurance, life insurance and health insurance. Sometimes they would allow, he said, or she said, sometimes I'll have a patient and he'll be allowed the treatment and the next patient won't be allowed the treatment. Sometimes I'll have to do an autopsy, you know, for various reasons. So in your situation, is there any way to guarantee that the halakha will be followed?
I think that's more a question you can deal with. What kind of influence do you have, control you have over that?
In terms of the law, it's very difficult to go against the law. And in terms of insurance fraud, it's very difficult to commit insurance fraud. You lose everything. So I'm not sure the specifics. And different insurance companies have different rules, so maybe one insurance company will allow a procedure and another insurance company will question. You can appeal it, and usually if you appeal strongly enough and there's a good reason, the insurance will allow. I'm not sure the specifics. In terms of autopsy, in my experience in Maryland, the examiner in Baltimore is very understanding of halakha. And if they know that there's a religious sensitivity, they'll often work with it, unless it's clearly a murder. If it's clearly a murder or there's a question of a crime, then it really halakha falls away. And from their perspective, halakha will fall away. Sometimes I've heard stories where, as Rabbi Grossman said, where there's a situation where you might be immediately life-saving. There's a situation where you want to learn more in terms of other people, and the law also is very firm about that. Then the examiner will take the evidence no matter what. But I think there's room in halakha to work with them for that. So I don't think that what the examples you've raised would contradict moral halakhic practice. And I think I can't imagine scenarios where that would be a problem with halakha.
I'll just add to what Dr. Heller said. This is probably not the common case, but the specific example of murder. People sometimes don't realize this, but there's actually many poskim, maybe even most poskim, have specifically ruled that we are allowed to cooperate with a forensic autopsy in a case of murder. They've argued that the need is great, the need to deter crime, that even for the sake of the victim, we would be happy if we catch the murderers. And there are a number of poskim who have ruled that Leo Kolatsky, the century ago, said sometimes he says relatives object, they block autopsies, it's a murder, they're wrong, they're obstructing justice from my logic perspective. So even that is not necessarily going to be against. As Dr. Ellis said, you have to figure out if there is a conflict in the first place. If we can avoid conflict, certainly it's good. If we actually have a conflict, we'd have to have more details, I guess, about exactly what it would be, and we'll see what we can do about it.
Thank you. This was a case of a multiple vehicle collision, and they were trying to assign blame to the
victim. I don't want to get too deeply into that.
That's why. It was complicated. Thank
okay, I think we have had a fantastic session with two experts, and we appreciate your coming to us. If you have specific questions, they may be able to stay for a couple of minutes. Thank you very much for coming. Stay tuned for the next program.